Our last speaker is Teresa Marteau. She studied psychology at the London School of Economics and Wolfson College, Oxford. And her research interests include risk perception and communication and their effect on behavior. She is director of the Behavior and Health Research Unit at the Institute of Public Health, University of the London School of Economics, and Queen Mary at the University of London. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I'm going to try and keep myself awake and everybody else awake and go quite quickly as we're right at the end of the day. First of all, I want to thank the people organising the meeting for inviting me. It's just been such a fantastic day, and I know that much of what I've heard already is going to inform my thinking over the next couple of years as I try to integrate the neuroscience with the task that I've been charged with in setting up a new unit in Cambridge. We're just starting appointing, we set up in January, funded by the Department of Health in the UK, and our principal aim is to develop ways of changing population behaviour to improve health and reduce inequalities, focusing on four behaviours of which eating is one. So I'm going to focus on areas where it seems that there's less promise, and then move on to areas where I'm more ignorant and there seems to be more promise, and maybe there's a relationship between the two. So I'm going to start off by talking about risk communication and the potential for feeding back to people the risks of developing disease, including risk of obesity-related diseases. And this is where I've spent 10 or more years of my research career. And there is a very strong, enduring belief that if people knew that they were at increased risk, then they would be motivated to change their behavior. And just in one slide, I just want to say the evidence does not support this. So the first review, published 10 years ago, looking at biomarker feedback for a range of conditions. It was looking at feedback of cholesterol, feedback of blood pressure. I think there was BMI in there as well. And of the one of the interesting things is there were only 8 trials that were found, and of those, none found a change in behavior. 3 of them finding an increase in motivation, but no behavioral change. More recently, a group of us have looked at the impact of DNA-based risk information because there's been a sense that this is a novel biomarker, that somehow this will be more potent. And we didn't find that many studies. We found 7 trials of single gene feedback and 6 analog studies. And again, the answer is no. It's very hard to shift people's behavior, which is partly why we're all still in this room. In keeping with that, the first study, it wasn't experimental, but observational study, direct-to-consumer genome-wide profiling to assess disease risk. And these were data pooled, I think it was around 1,500 people who'd undergone testing for vulnerability to a range of common complex conditions. And the only point to note here was they looked at 2 behaviors, intake of dietary fat and exercise, which were common to reducing the risk for the conditions that were looked at. And if you look at baseline scores and follow-up scores, you'll find that there is no impact. So impact on behavior of this particular approach, be fair to say it's modest at best. So moving on to nutritional labeling, which is another form of feeding back information. I mean, there are many, many reasons for labeling food, but one of them is to try to motivate people to make purchases that are healthier, as well as to consume in a way that's going to be healthier in this particular context to reduce or prevent obesity. Any number of ways in which food is labelled, and at the moment we don't know what the effect is. And just to note that a group of us have registered and have started a Cochrane review looking at the impact of nutritional labelling on both food purchasing and consumption. So I'm just going to quickly show you some studies. which show, first of all, no impact of nutritional labelling. Observational work in New York and Newark before and after mandatory labelling. And first of all, I don't know the subtleties of the population in New York and Newark, but in New York, certainly the population claimed to have noticed the calorie labels more than those in Newark. And in New York, they claimed that it influenced their purchasing. But when you look at the number of calories that are bought before and after labeling in New York City and Newark, the amount of saturated fat and sodium and sugar, there is no difference at all. Another study, these are all completely different methods, and as I say, it's hard to draw conclusions. So this is looking at the impact of calorie labelling on consumption. This is an experimental study in which participants were randomly allocated to be selecting food where there was no calorie label, a calorie label plus detailed information on daily nutritional requirements. And with the initial meal, you can possibly see that those where there were calorie labels were consuming less, but for those where there was only a label with no additional information, what they chose after the studied meal for their pudding, it made up for the calories that they hadn't selected on the initial meal. So the point to make really is that labelling per se, I think the devil's going to be in the detail. It's about what information is being given alongside the label. And just to remind ourselves that our interventions can also make things worse. So some of you will be familiar with the work of Brian Wansink in his laboratory, and they've looked at low-fat labels. So the experimental paradigm is that people are randomly allocated to help themselves to M&Ms, which are exactly the same but labelled either as regular or low fat. And if you just look at the dark blue bars here in terms of actual calorie consumption, what they found was no main effect but an interaction according to body weight. So the participants who were overweight, when led to believe that they were eating low fat M&Ms, consumed more, and in fact consumed more calories than those who were thinking that they were eating the regular M&Ms. So this is sometimes described as the American paradox. How come so much low-fat food is going into bodies that are getting bigger and bigger? This could be one explanation. So the overall impact on behavior is unknown, and there is potential for benefit, but there's also potential for harm. 5 minutes, right, okay, I'll go even faster. fighting with my jet lag. So I think that this is an area where it's certainly ripe for experiments to find out how to present the labels in ways that might prevent the perverse effects and maximise any potential benefit. So these kinds of interventions very much rely on people's reflective goal-directed systems. So I think that there is potential for looking at the other side of dual process models to think about habit acquisition and priming. So here's another dual process model. They're all variants on a theme. And this one, as we've already heard throughout the day, this is two psychologists, Strack and Deutsch, who describe a reflective system and an impulsive system. So, as we've heard, reflective system is driven by a decision. There is an idea that there's a future represented, but it needs high cognitive capacity. So the example being given here is that there's a dessert in the room, and when the reflective system is operating and someone has a value, losing weight is good, they form a goal to lose weight. And if their reflective system is operating, then they leave a room and they find themselves not eating the dessert. Under the impulsive or automatic system, a dessert is there. Assuming their approach orientation is generally positive towards dessert, before they know it, the dessert has been consumed. So as already been mentioned, it's driven by the immediate environment, the idea of a future isn't represented, and it's extremely fast. So I think that this is where there's mileage for thinking about approach orientation, and this can be driven by habit as well as by being primed in the environment. So I'm just going to give an example of one of the few studies I'm aware of where there has been success in instilling habits, new habits, that are healthy. So this is the Food Dudes program that some of you may or may not be familiar with, which is, I think the first findings were published nearly 10 years ago now. And in it, children aged between 4 and 11 in primary school are exposed to a 16-day program, which is based on exposure and repeated tasting of small amounts of fruit and vegetables. Parents are involved as well as teachers. The teachers run the program. There's peer modeling through cartoon adventures of food dudes versus the junk punks. And the children get very small rewards for tasting a wide range of fruit and vegetables. And in the control group, they're just exposed to fruit and vegetables. And as I say, the study has been run in many different contexts. And just to show, these are data from 12-month follow-up. This is just looking at the content of fruit and vegetables in the lunch boxes from the kids. And as you can see in the experimental group, 1 year later, they're still bringing to school more fruit and vegetables, and they are actually consuming it as well, compared with the control group. In the Republic of Ireland, this is now carried out as part of every primary school, but the rest of, in the UK, it has not yet been implemented. So that's just one example of how habit acquisition may be helpful. I'm now going to run through, extremely quickly, some examples of priming effects. And I think we know quite a lot about priming for unhealthy behaviours, but the question is, can we change that around and use semantic and behavioural priming for healthy consumption? So this is one of the first studies, Kelly Brownell and John Barg, in which they documented, through an experimental design, small children watching cartoons. In half of them, they're exposed to food ads, not for goldfish, and the other half, non-food ads. And in front of both groups of children were a bowl of relatively appetizing, or at least for the children, goldfish. And as you can see, when there were food advertisements in between the cartoons, the children consumed 42% more of those crackers. Priming of purchasing, recently documented in an Australian study, in which they looked at the impact of using sports celebrities on cereal packets. And in terms of the semantic priming, it was interesting that where there's a sports celebrity, the foods, which are energy-dense, nutrient-poor, were perceived as healthier and of better quality, and these are parents intended to buy them more. Very often in advertisements, there's a use of incidental foods, particularly healthy foods, and we don't know what the effects of those are, but work from Chernoff suggests that they may have paradoxical effects. So in looking at calorie estimation in weight-conscious and weight-indifferent people, where a hamburger is presented, you can see the estimates of the calories, but if you add 3 celery sticks, you get a negative impact on the calories. They disappear. It's true. So we then have to start asking the question, well, what is going on inside people's minds when they're seeing the juxtaposition of these different foods? So as I say, the question is, how can we prime healthier behaviour? So these are just sort of 2 images that I recently came across. So Shane Warne, some of you may know, a sports person, but he's also a sort of shady character. He's a fun-loving, edgy guy who is promoting McDonald's. Here we have a very fine woman, a virtuous woman, standing by the fruit and vegetables. So we have to ask, what is the impact, the juxtaposition of these different different images? So just to end, as I've said, I've summarised on those, and in terms of behaviour change, thinking about dual process models, I think that there is untapped potential working with the automaticity of human behaviour, which I think is what's got us into this mess, and I think that we can, over the next few years, do more work to see whether or not it holds the clue for getting us a little bit of the way out of it. Thanks very much.